Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that feels $158 billion richer. Well, at least not personally, but on behalf of the country, Doc. It's been a big week.
I don't feel that rich.
I'm Scott Phillips, and with me as always, as you just heard, is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. We've got a big week on the podcast, mate. Some macro news, some company news, and a little bit of ranting, a little bit of high horse maybe. We'll see how the podcast eventuates, and if we have time at the end, we almost certainly will, a little bit of your mailbag as well. Mate, it's been a cracking week for people who like a little bit more money in the kick. Let's get on with it.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/triple M.
This week, we had two big bits of news. Both kind of not unexpected, but also not exactly expected, or at least not forecast the way it might have been. Let's start with the boffins in Martin Place. The central bankers, Phil Lowe, Governor Phil Lowe and the Reserve Bank Board, decided this week that we were paying a little bit too much for our mortgages. And as of sometime soon, we'll have a little bit of rate cut relief on the horizon. The official cash rate cut by another 25 basis points from 1.25 down to 1%. That means of the six bullets it had left to fire, it's fired two of them. We've gone from 1.5 to 1 in the space of 2 months. Either a great salve for the economy or panic stations. What do you reckon?
Panic.
Tell me. That's a very quick podcast. And thank you for listening. No, I'm kidding. What do you make of the rate cut, mate? Justified or not? Worthwhile or not? Signs of the last throw of the dice or prudent activity in enough time to make a difference?
Well, as our colleague Kevin Gandia said, what's interesting is that how much data came in 1 month that gave Lowy the confidence that he, or the data or the whatever he needed to cut by another, 25 basis points?
Do you know what? That is the question. I would love to be on the inside. We know that there's so much data out there. They've seen it all, of course. But something changed. So 2 months ago, we were 1.5. And the RBA had, to that point, said, look, we're pretty balanced. We kind of feel comfortable. 2 months later, they've gone twice.
Yeah.
And Lowe has also called on the government to spend a bit more money, and we'll get to that in a sec. But there is some sense that something either has changed, either the data's changed, or frankly, Lowe's perception or the board's perception of the economy's changed, or something's gone on, either at headquarters or out and about, that's convinced them to cut rates twice in the space of 31 days.
Yeah, I find it very hard to believe that there's data. Actually, I have been very appreciative of or glowing in my review of what he's doing.
And you've been a big Governor Lowe fan.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give him an F now.
Oh no! Oh dear! All right.
Because I just think that either this is like a panic station type of, thing, okay, nothing is working. It's a signal that, okay, the economy is really in difficulty and therefore we need to cut. And maybe the government needs to do. Maybe this is like a political move that's where, saying, okay, the economy really, really is in trouble. Mm. And therefore I'm going to cut twice in a row. And now the government should do something. Mm. So I just find it's hard. I mean, if the data was such when the first rate cut was done, that suggested that we needed more of a stimulus, then maybe they should have done a double cut at one go, which they didn't.
So 50 basis points in one go. Yeah,
I would buy that.
Right.
So I have hard time buying this. The other thing that I think about the rate cut is, it's suggestive that the economy or what he's basically saying that he wants the rates he's going to cut rates until he can get the economy's unemployment rate below 5%. So match up with what's happening in the US and the UK, where the unemployment rates are well and below 4%, right? So he's willing to cut more, is what he said. The thing that I'm not sure is that if this cutting of the rate actually does that job, that's number one. I think there's a side effect too that I think I'm worried about. So as you cut the rates, you're reducing the amount of money people get on, say, things like deposits, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So you're reducing money for one side, let's say the retired people who were actually spending, now they have a little bit less to spend in that sense, right? So that has an impact, right? So, and the other impact to consider is as you cut the rates, I mean, ultimately the banks are not going to be able to, most of the banks did not pass except for ANZ, which, got a lot of flack last time for not passing.
That was almost certain they were going to cut this time. But interestingly enough, And maybe it's because it was a second cut in a row. But as you say, the rest of the big banks didn't go and was they got nowhere near the grief this time. I think ANZ went first and went soft the first time. Going out first with a partial cut really put them in the crosshairs.
Yeah.
I have to think they'll probably, hopefully, signalling to the other banks that, hey, we're not going hard. You guys don't need to either.
Yeah.
This case, they went full and early. The other banks didn't. And I very rarely feel sorry for banks, but I feel a little bit sorry for ANZ. They got the rounds of the kitchen a month ago.
Yeah.
This time the other three banks hardly got touched.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is basically acknowledging that we have gotten to the point where the rate cuts are going to have less and less impact in terms of reducing rates.
And the governor has actually said exactly that, right? Yeah. He's got limited capacity now. Each rate cut, and it makes sense. If you cut from 7 to 6, the quantum of that's pretty big.
If you
cut from 1.5 to 1, if you the way interest rates work, the compound value of 1.5 and the compound value of 1 are just pretty close together, right? If you're compounding at 6 or 8, the difference of that over 30 is actually massive.
Yeah.
Just between 1 or 1.5 or even 1 and 2 over that period of time is just much, much lower because you're not getting that compound effect that we talk about all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are a couple of things, other things happening, which is, again, like, you know, if the rates stay this low, ultimately the net interest margin or the amount of money that actually the banks make on the lending and the borrowing is going to shrink, which means the bank's profitabilities are in question. Like, there are reports out already saying that, you know, next year's profits are going to look really bad for the banks. That in turn has impacts on those people who have bank shares and a lot of other shares that pay dividends and so on, because dividends might get actually cut.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know how this thing is actually overall. I mean, there's a limit to cutting that that needs to, you know, be. And then the final thing that I think is that I think we're getting used to too much of a low interest rate environment, which I think in the long run is actually not good.
Well, the bank had done nothing for 3 years. And I saw Stephen Kokoulis, the economist, tweeted yesterday, the day before, there's people saying it's the first two cuts in this cycle. He made the point that actually, no, it's been a 7 or 8 year cycle of cuts.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's really been that, you know, the current cycle, the current, what do they call it?
Super cycle or something.
Just the current path from high to low, this kind of cutting cycle is now 7 or 8 years long.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's kind of, well, it's a quarter of the average loan length. So if you kind of flow that through the economy, somewhere around 25% of people have experienced nothing, of mortgage holders, have experienced nothing other than falling rates and then, as you say, low rates.
So, So I think there's some psychological issues or, you know, behavioral issues that are going to come into play because of this. You know, people are going to assume that this is what the normal is when this is actually definitely does not look like the normal.
Right.
So I'm actually not. Well, I like the extra money coming into the bank account.
You're not donating it back?
No, I'm not. Oh, why should I donate it back? Right? I mean, I didn't get the $158 billion, right, as you said. But I mean, I just, you know, think about it. I just don't like the sound of this. And so I'm not a happy camper. As I said, I've given him an F. I'm sure he doesn't need my grading, but that's my view on this.
I'm going to be a little less scathing than you, mate. I am reminded of one of our former colleagues, Morgan Housel, who was talking about, I think it must have been Ben Bernanke back in the day. It might have even been Janet Yellen, somebody. Just the extent that whenever we criticize central bankers, we kind of assume we're right and they're wrong. And the chance that we actually know more about central banking than them, and I don't mean you and I necessarily, I mean anyone who's having a view on this, the chance that, you know, we're kind of more qualified, more informed, more able to make a better decision. I'm always reminded that we just need to be a little bit careful when we bag those guys because they kind of do this for a living and they've spent, you know, literally decades learning about the art and science of central banking. So I'm a little less prone to rush to judgment on either side of this one. I think to some degree too, I agree with part of your point, at least in the sense that they obviously felt like they needed to go and go hard. And whatever kind of stat or data scared them into this, I think scared's probably almost the right word, they obviously knew the negative implications, right? They knew it was going to hurt pensioners. They knew it was going to potentially cause side effects down the road in terms of, as you say, people borrowing more than they otherwise could afford to pay at higher rates or simply getting used to paying lower rates and not having the same psychological kind of defenses or preparation for when rates go higher again. I've got to feel they looked at that and said, you know what, despite all that, this is still what we need to do. Net-net, this is still the best course of action for the economy. I have been and continue to be scathing of government, and I'll say politicians rather than government because I don't want to be political about it, but the governments have been, even back in Glenn Stevens' time, he was calling for the governments to spend more money to stimulate the economy, to kind of do more than the RBA can. I kind of use the analogy, it's a poor one, but you know, the RBA is flying a biplane with one machine gun kind of button on the front, And the government to fly a modern fighter jet with, you know, controls and dials and switches and levers. Governments can do an amazing array of different things in different areas with different durations. The ABA has got one button to press, one lever to pull, right? Either rates go up, they go down, or they stay still. That's all that Governor Lowe can do compared to the federal politicians of both stripes who can choose to stimulate or otherwise the economy in a million different ways. So I feel a little bit sorry for the central bankers because they're being... Well, and this is kind of a global thing, right? They're the adults in the room where politicians globally are saying, oh, I don't know what to do. You guys kind of fix it over there. Now we're in a situation where the central bankers have kind of done what they can and maybe even more than they should have had to, as you say, because the pollies have been asleep at the wheel. You're staying out of that one, aren't you?
All I'm saying is that I know nothing about central banking, but that doesn't mean that I can't say anything.
No, I agree with that. Yeah,
that basically means that I can, you know, say whatever I want with zero consequences.
That's the best place to be, right? Yeah. Much easier to be in the cheap seats over here, you know, throwing popcorn rather than having to be on in the arena.
You know, I can give my opinion, which counts for nothing.
And, as does mine.
You mean
Phil, I didn't call you or I to ask what we already should do with rates?
Yeah, he didn't call us.
Phil, if you're listening, and I'm sure you are, feel free to give us a call. You can hit us up on Twitter if you want, Phil. We're happy to. You can even direct message us, mate. Our DMs are open. You can message us and ask us what you should do next.
But for my advice, I would like to be paid.
Oh, you're a hard man. No, you're not going to do it with the national interest out of the goodness of your heart to help your fellow Australians?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I understand the governor is paid well for national interest. I mean, you know, if it's national interest, he should be working for free. So
he's not working for free, you shouldn't
either.
Here's
the other thing, right? Free advice is dangerous.
Yeah.
So
worth exactly what you pay for it, I've heard.
Hey, yeah, so, you know, if I am paid, then I'll give my very worthwhile advice.
Very good. Which is not to say this whole podcast is useless because we don't get paid to do it, right?
I didn't say anything about the podcast.
Let's move on, shall we?
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking about governments, Doc, I mentioned at the top of the show that we're feeling $158 billion richer. Not necessarily you or I individually, maybe not even our listeners as a group. Although I'd like to think all of Australia is listening to us. That might be too forlorn, I hope, is it?
I heard people... Most of Australia. Don't people from outside Australia listen to us?
There you go.
Yeah.
So we're even bigger. We might have a 30 million person audience.
We're huge.
Doc said we've got 30 million people listening to us. That's awesome. I'm going to quote that. oh, man. Early tangent. Mate, $158 billion worth of tax cuts either have been or are about to be passed by federal parliament. It went through the House of Reps. I don't know if it's been through the Senate at the time of recording, but if not, it'd be very, very soon after because apparently from all reports, the crossbench in the Senate has agreed to support the government's tax plan. All three phases, the ones that go out to 2024 or something, which frankly is one or two terms of parliament away, but such is politics these days. $158 billion, the interesting thing about this one is normally governments announce tax cuts from a point in time in the future. This one's actually going to be backdated. So it'll actually apply to the 2018-2019 financial year that just finished, which is kind of cool because it means we're going to get a tax cut for money we've already earned. That, you know, it's nice to kind of have on the way through. Here's the story. So basically the way the tax, it's a low and middle income tax offset. So if you're listening, well, you are listening by definition, but as you're listening to this, I'll just go through some numbers and then Doc will ask for your thoughts. If you earned under $37,000, you're going to get $255 back when you do your tax return. Now, I don't say back necessarily. You won't necessarily get the cash. If you have a tax debt, it'll come off your tax debt. If you're getting a refund already, that'll be an extra money you get. But effectively, you'll either pay $255 less tax or you'll get $255 more than you would have otherwise. Either way, you're ahead by $255. If you earn between $37,000 and $48,000, you'll get somewhere between $255 and $1,080. If you earn between $48,000 and $90,000, you get the full $1,080 back in the kick. If you earn between $90,000 and $126,000, it starts at $1,080 and goes down to zero by the time you get to $126,000. And if you earn over that, well, you don't need a tax cut. Good luck to you. You've done well. So that's the broad numbers. Most people getting something. The vast bulk of taxpayers getting $1,080 because that's roughly where most taxpayers are between that $48,000 and $90,000. So, mate, decent amount of cash. Some people say it's a little bit reminiscent of the old GFC cash splash, the Kevin Rudd, Wayne Swan cash they threw at us to try and make us spend and keep the country out of recession. They got plenty of grief for that. And in some quarters justified because it was a little bit untargeted and it kind of got thrown all over the place and there was pink bats and school halls and all that sort of stuff. And again, we'll have people listening to us who either love or hate individual parties and they'll have their own views. Broadly speaking, though, I'm reminded that that quarter, The Australian economy grew by 0.1% after going backwards the previous quarter. So there's a decent argument to make that whether you like it or hate it, it kept us out of recession, which leads me to the question, is this enough to keep the Australian economy from some of the worst of what might otherwise be coming?
So I don't have an answer for that. And actually, what I like about this is it targets those taxpayers who are most likely to need the cut. So that, right. I think that's a tick in my book.
Yep.
I'll tell you what's not a tick. I think the government for ages actually has been spending what I would call, and many governments around the world have this tendency, they have a tendency to spend on things that they think are going to give you immediate benefit, which everybody likes an immediate benefit.
The sugar but, rush, mate. It's all about the sugar rush. Yeah, but, We've got kids.
But, you know, I'm going to just go on a bit of a tangent and go to the ASX, right? Tech sector on the ASX is less than 2%.
Yes.
Right? And why is that? It's because the government has not spent enough money to encourage sort of, you know, disruptive and other sort of technology building innovation, mm-hmm. you know. So, and those take time actually to develop, right? So you need to spend today for getting the benefit 10 years from now, right? I know the conversations, for example, you know, people like to talk about tax and we, you know, the conversation is, okay, we need to tax Netflix because, mm-hmm. you know, Netflix is taking... Okay, that's fine. You know, Netflix is not doing anything illegal currently. I get it that you want to digitally tax. I get it. But, you know, it's a little bit of it's a little bit of a whinge complaining in the sense that, you know, can we not just have the Netflix here? Let's have our own Netflix and then everybody can, then we can have the tax and
Ozflix.
Ozflix, right?
DocFlix.
So I am all for, I think we need to do a little bit more to, you know, get the Netflixes of the world. We need more Atlassians. Mm-hmm. We need more, you know, other companies like Elmos and stuff here. And I think that is where I would like them to actually spend a little bit more.
For those who don't know, Elmo is not the 3.5-year-old Sesame Street character. You're talking about the HR software company.
So, like, you know, and the 1.8% that we have that we call tech sector also lists a lot of New Zealand companies, right? Why aren't they here, right? I mean, you know, they could have been companies that are actually instituted here that create jobs here and so on and so forth. So I think that is something that I think should be rectified. Otherwise, we risk the chance of being an old economy. So I think that what the government is doing is fine. Maybe it'll help us out of recession. We're not in recession yet. So I mean, you know, so if you're not in recession, there's not really two quarters of negative growth, right? So we haven't had the first quarter of negative growth yet. So maybe this does the trick.
You throw that on top of the RBA's kind of rate cuts. Hopefully, the headlines have been a bit positive. Hey, we've all got a bit more money in our pockets. Maybe we go and spend. We've said this before. The economy is a confidence machine.
Yeah.
And frankly, it's not going to matter. The $1,080 is both not enough and more than enough to keep us out of recession. Because it really depends on how we otherwise think about it. If you think the economy is going to go into recession, you're going to save the $1,080, you're going to put it away for a rainy day, no more money goes into the economy, and we go careening off a cliff. If you think, great, I'm so glad, the economy is obviously fine, we're all okay, now let's go and spend all that money. I spend it at your shop, you spend it at my shop, we both spend it at someone else's shop, and the economy goes around the economy, goes around the economy, they reckon up to 6 times. So for every dollar of stimulus or input into the economy, they reckon up to $6 of economic activity is generated because I spend it with you, you spend it with someone else, they spend it with someone else, they spend it with someone else. That, in theory, boosts economic activity. That's certainly what the RBA and the government are hoping. Remains to be seen if we feel good enough about the economy to keep spending or whether we batten down the hatches because we fear there's worse to come. And I think the jury's kind of split on that, right? There's a decent number of people who are concerned and a decent number of people who are, as you say, and I agree with you about these tax cuts, they are targeted at the people who are most likely, not only who need it most, which is important on a social, personal level, but economically on the people who are most likely to spend it. If you go and give, let's pick someone, what's his name? Anthony Pratt. Owner of Visy Industries, richest man in the country, give him another $1,000. He's probably not going to spend it. He's probably got more than enough already. He's already spent everything he's going to spend. He'll put that in the bank. There's no more economic activity created. Now, you can argue about whether it's fairer or not for taxes to be higher or lower for different people. We're not getting that argument today. But, you know, he's not going to spend it. If you give $1,000 to someone who's living on the streets or in rental stress or mortgage stress, who can't pay the electricity bill, who otherwise, you know, might go and buy another pair of shoes for the kids, that stuff is going to go straight into the economy almost entirely. So it's got the most chance of having the best possible economic impact. And that's probably a good thing, I think.
No, I agree. I think I like targeted, you know, tax benefits. These are not really, I would call them benefits and calling them tax. Yeah, I think the targeted stuff is absolutely good because it does a social good and I think it has an economic impact of it. So
that's a pretty good combination.
Yeah, it's a good combination to have. So yeah, I really like that.
Mate, I'm going to throw you, you know how we like tangents on this podcast? I'm going to throw you a question because you talk about the extra investment in science and tech, and you and I have had some disagreements around the edges on some of this stuff. So I'm not going to argue with you, but I will throw you the outright question, which is if you were in charge of policy and you were in charge of industry support, assistance, call it what you will, investment, big kind of, you know, lumpy kind of tough area to get your head around. How do you think about how much money, and let's move just away from tech specifically, you can talk about that if you want. But if you're in charge of policy, how do you work out how much cash you can put in? How much is too much? How long is the piece of string? Where do you start and stop with that kind of investment? If I was treasurer for a day and you said, we need money for the arts or for sport or for science or for research. And I said, well, how much do you need? So X dollars. So, well, why not 2X or half X? How do you think about, how should the government think about the kind of the way to think about policy in that context? It's a really lumpy one, right? I can say, well, welfare should be X because this is what it takes to rent and pay for food and live, and I get that bit. We can say, well, this is how much a swimming pool costs to keep up, so we've got to have that much for that in our council rates. Those things are really easy to do. The kind of, you know, the really rubbery, kind of fuzzy future possibility stuff. How do you think about how much the government should invest in those kind of areas?
Yeah, so it's a hard question to answer.
Why I asked you, mate.
I'm going to try to qualify that answer with some examples, right? Right. So maybe internet, for example, is one of the, you know, the greatest inventions of modern kind. Yeah. Right? Now, if you think about where the internet came from, it came from DARPA, which is basically defense research out of the US. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened, you know, you could say that I'm basically telling a story or I'm basically connecting dots and making some conclusions. So I don't have scientific evidence to back this, but I'll say this. So, it's, you know, 1969, 1970, DARPA created the internet. Mm-hmm. The internet then was initially a military operation or a military thing, and then it got, it spread to a few universities in the US. Okay. Some of the greatest companies of our time actually came out of products of those. So people who were doing PhDs at, you know, some of the top universities, like four or five of them, you could see that these people basically went on to create, you know, the great companies of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen? Because they got exposed to some technology before anybody else, right? The rest of the world basically did not see the internet as we know it until like 1990s. Like, right. I mean, basically.
Yeah.
Right. The, you
know, emails, as we know it today.
Yeah. Basically. So that is a 20-year leap ahead. In some cases, 25, 30 years. That's an extremely difficult. That's where all the internet technology companies are in the U.S.
Right.
And it's been very hard to beat that, right? We can complain about taxes. I said, you know, I think complaining about taxes and the digital taxes is basically whinging about stuff that
We can make a podcast about that for years.
Yeah, like I think it's basically whinging about the wrong thing. Now, so there's nothing inherently in Australia that would say that, you know, we can't succeed, right? Sure. But I think we have not been given the right combination. I'll give an example. So in audio networking technology, Australia is the world leader. It's a small company called Audinate. Mm-hmm. It was spun out.
So Audinate, and the code is AD8 for those following along at home.
Yeah. That company was spun out of an Australian government research funded organization called NICTA, right? It was one of the first spin outs. And, you know, today it's nearly a $1 billion company employing so many people.
Some very cool tech, too.
It's very cool tech, right? So I think, you know, take Atlassian as an example, right? There's another company that was, you know, created in Australia. So I think we can, but I think we need, you know, research funding and R&D funding with long-term horizon. You can't expect returns to happen immediately. In this thing, returns don't happen immediately. Right, and there's the flow-on effect that, and I use the internet as an example, and maybe we're not going to invent something that's like the internet, but the flow-on effect of the internet has been humongous, right? I mean, you know,
it's enormous. Well, people listening to this now on internet-enabled devices, I mean, our podcast wouldn't exist. This podcast alone is enough to justify the U.S. Defense Department's investment in the internet.
Exactly. Oh, internet, Uber, anything that you use today, it has been enabled by the internet.
You mentioned Uber. Another thing is, I don't want to get you off track, but GPS came out of U.S. military, right? So without that, Uber could be an app on your phone, but it couldn't know where you were. Right. You wouldn't know where you were.
Yeah.
It's the GPS combined with the internet that makes that possible.
So, I mean, you know, I think like a policy that says it's one small percentage of your, you know, whatever is it, government budget, GDP, or whatever you want to say, however you want to do it, but a small percentage that you devote on a long-term basis, and then you reap the benefits out of that. And I think that helps you when the world is moving towards tech, because if you think about it, you know, if you use Google's Duplex as an example, right? This is the technology where the AI basically talks to you. So it takes
very cool.
Takes restaurant reservations.
Yeah.
imagine if this becomes the becomes actually feasible technology. Mm. How many jobs actually basically going to disappear? Because you know, companies are going to, you know, because restaurants are going to basically say, I don't need person to take the call because I'm going to use Google Duplex.
Yeah, makes sense.
So
as much as restaurants, right? If that does work, that just becomes huge.
It's huge.
Every call center, but a whole heap of call centers, that sort of stuff starts to take over a massive amount of otherwise kind of relatively routine tasks.
Right. And think of the small business sector, right? Small business sector in Australia is huge, right? Mm. But all these people, all the small businesses have a front desk basically taking calls, right? Well, those could disappear, right? So I'm not, you know, fear-mongering here, but I mean, what I think is that, you know, we need to invest and we need to train people so that they are, you know, prepared for. And then there's, again, as I said, there's no reason that we would be behind. You know, we have some of the best, you know, the best weather, the best food, the best location, the, you know, the best animals, the best flora, fauna. We've got the best sharks too. So,
mate, there's no platypus anywhere else, just quietly. The platypus is ours and we're claiming it. It's the most unlikely animal in the world and it's ours.
Well, the kangaroos. And I mean, again, I just think that there's no reason for us to be behind on those things.
There is kind of the best tech, yeah.
Sure. So why shouldn't we be doing it?
Would you? So my take on this would be if the government was to fund it, then the government should swap the funding for some sort of equity stake to make sure that the taxpayer gets some sort of, I mean, obviously the economy grows, so that's its own return, but also the government gets some sort of upside. If we had, as Australian government, 10% of Atlassian, for example, or you know, an X percent of Audinate or something else, is that how you might otherwise get some money back from that, or would you just simply be happy enough with the GDP growth?
No, so to your point, that was exactly the model. So the government directly did not own a stake, but the government via NICTA. NICTA was government funded, then became part of CSIRO. So, I mean, it's not that the government doesn't do. What I'm saying is that, so CSIRO, for example, has a stake. I don't know whether they've sold it now or not. Yeah. But they did have a stake along with the founders in the business, right?
Sounds like a pretty good model, right?
That's a very good model.
Risk sharing.
And it's a great model, but I'm just saying that, you know, there's more of that can be done and more with consistency because, you know, having worked in these environments, I know that every 4 years, basically, there's a struggle. Oh, are we going to get funded? You know, are we going to get money? Are we all going to be, you know, fired? you know, and that is not the environment in which you can actually succeed. It's amazing that the success actually is happening.
Funding cycles are mad. I mean, ABC, very, very different thing, but same kind of problem, right? We have to go back to cap in hand every 3 years and say, can I please have some more money? It's madness.
This madness. I would say that this is, if government of both, and again, politics on both sides, fund these things for, like, you know, whether ABC, again, you know, world-class institution, fund it for like 15 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Fund it for 20 years.
So sort of guaranteed funding. Yeah. Yeah.
2 decades of funding, right? I mean, we can afford that.
And vote one and Irban Mahanti. He will drag us kicking and screaming into the 21st century in a positive way. Mate, thank you for that. Massive tangent. I didn't warn you about that, but I think it was a really interesting kind of conversation to have and hopefully a good one for our listeners as well. Let's move on away from the government. Oh, I was going to say, maybe not sublime to the ridiculous.
That's
maybe
not a good segue. It's not Captain, great, you it? Can do better.
All right, stand by.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Okay, from the sublime to... No, it didn't get any better. All right, let's just move on. Mate, we talk about Vocus a little bit, and we're not going to spend too much time on it because, frankly, it's been such a basket case of a story over the last couple of years that not many of our listeners probably own it anymore. Maybe some do, hoping that, against hope, maybe things will get better. They haven't.
No.
So Vocus has had more marriage breakups than... Who's had more... One of the socialites, somebody important. I'll come. We'll fix that in post production.
I don't like to put names. You know, what if they sue me? Although if they sue me, they have nothing to get.
Talk about being left at the altar. So we're talking about Vocus being left at the altar plenty of times. Luckily for them, maybe, I don't know if it's lucky or not, it wasn't that this time. Mm. This time, it's all about the business itself, and maybe this might explain why it's been left at the altar a couple of times. The future is going to be pretty tepid for Vocus, from the sound of it.
Yes. So I think the forecast for 2020, again, this is a forecast, right? I mean, how good is the forecast going to be? It's basically, you know, in the identical band predicted for 2019. So basically no growth.
So the best they want us to expect, the best is going to be flat.
The best is flat.
That's as good as it gets.
That's as good as it gets. And the retail internet side basically is you know, is not doing well, which has been a pain point for many others. But you know,
it has, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I suspect that's probably the lack of earnings growth and the potential actually maybe to even sell off businesses or parts of the business is what has scared all these people off from the altar.
Plus a heap of debt.
Plus a heap of debt.
Mate, so again, without going down too many more tangents, retail internet you mentioned. For the longest time, the Vocuses and the Amcoms and M2 and TPG and IINet and Telstra and Vodafone, or it was not really listed, but Vodafone Hutchison was, Optus. I mean, plenty of these businesses, there was a pretty good 5 or 6 years of just kind of hyper growth for these guys. And I'm curious now, looking back, it's easy to look back in hindsight and say, well, we should have known that or should have known this. But just diagnose it for me for a second, because there's probably hopefully a teaching moment in this somewhere. Were investors right and then wrong? Do we expect too much for too long? Should we have seen a kind of a flattening of growth coming? Was this mismanagement by the companies? Was it the market that fell over? If you'd have diagnosed kind of the story, obviously a lot of people made a lot of money. Vocus was a $2 stock, then was a $12 stock, now is a $3 stock or something. And some I won't say mismanagement because I don't want to get sued by anybody, but probably some management missteps, maybe I can say, in that as well. Just kind of try and give me a quick potted kind of view of that. 5, 6 years later, the promise has been fulfilled in large part. The fiber build-out is done. We've all got relatively decent broadband. We won't get the NBN conversation. But, you know, most of kind of what was expected has almost come to pass in a big picture story. But investors have, by and large, I want to say if you looked sort of 3 years ago and then today at all those companies, investors have probably lost money overall over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yes, that's a good question. And I mean, you know, at your service, for example, ShareAdvisor, right? I mean, we've made...
I didn't. Telstra's not beating the market.
No, fine. Putting Telstra aside, all the others that were basically part of this, you know, land grab sort of thing that was going on, you know, those made money, including, you know, a couple of wrecks to even TPG, right?
Yes.
two nods to TPG that made money. So I think in there was this period of aggregation, right? Mm-hmm. So when we had all these small players, there was this opportunity for the small players to be aggregated under the bigger hood, which, and then you could remove some costs and, you know, so some synergies, some costs, which basically gave you growth, right?
And in some cases we had, I think Vocus was strong on the East Coast and Amcom was strong on the West Coast. So that kind of gave them a national network. And
Right. And then as we shrunk to like, you know, four big players, basically that, you know, we've basically gone down to population growth opportunities.
Right.
What I think did not happen fast enough was the PEs. Mm. You know, the PEs were in like, so PE being price to earnings ratios. They were high for when the aggregation was happening, which made sense because, you know, there was this growth to be had via putting things together, synergies. And here, actually, there was real synergies to have, as you said, East Coast, West Coast, right?
And the last part, that did actually play out in terms of profit growth and revenue growth. Like it seemed to have been a legitimate approach.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, the big guys got a little bit maybe greedy, thinking, okay, now, I mean, all companies, all CEOs, if I was a CEO of a big company, I'd think, okay, how do I get growth, right?
Right.
I mean, it's
how do I get bigger? Yeah,
how do I get bigger, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what the board pays you. That's what the shareholders pay for. So it's
what
a
gets
natural.
Measured gets done.
So I think that's what happened. And then and it took a while maybe for the market to sort of realize that the PEs need to shrink, right? Yeah. And that's what happened. So,
okay.
Yeah, that's my view.
Was it the companies that screwed up, or did investors simply misunderstand, but did they simply misprice the longevity of growth, the price they were prepared to pay? Because there's plenty of growth companies out there right now, and this is interesting because I think if we took a you know, kind of swab across the ASX now, there'll be some companies that in 3 years' time we look back and go, man, people really expected growth for much longer than it came about, a la telcos. In others, I know, and pick the Apples or the Googles or the Amazons or the, you know, the Facebooks even, you know, they've had you know, decade plus, you know, growth stories. Sometimes growth goes on for years and almost no price is too expensive. Other times the growth kind of comes to a pretty sudden, not necessarily a halt, but it comes back to the field pretty quickly. And that's when investors can really have their backsides handed to them.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think this is like a formula, but maybe a formula is, you know, there's no formula that's a perfect formula.
Well, I like that. Get the pens out, guys. Here we go.
So the one formula is that if the business is small and if the market is fragmented, which basically means there are multiple players, but this market is large enough and there are multiple players, then aggregation can create value.
Nice, okay.
Right? But there's a limit to the aggregation because once whoever is the one or two big players, they've become big enough, then to find the next thing to buy that's going to give you enough growth and enough heft becomes harder. Mm-hmm. And as you become bigger, it becomes harder and harder to find that growth because your growth was actually not organic, right? The growth was coming from acquisitions. And
there was a little bit of organic growth. They were laying more fiber and more cable, but even that had some sort of kind of finite potential, right?
It's fine. Again, you know, I mean, we're a small country. I mean, we're a big country, but small country in population-wise, right? I mean, so, we're only growing
Yeah, 8 or 9 major population centers right around the coast. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, whatever is the population growth, that's the number of internet connections you need. That's the number of, you know, mobile connections you need, right? So, I mean, that limits what we can do.
Yeah.
So I think so it took maybe investors a while. And this is the, you know, there's always a lag with investors a while to sort of readjust their expectations, I guess.
So fair to say we just got carried away.
For a little bit. I mean, most of the time. I mean, you got carried away for a little bit, but, you know, the market then has self-calibrated itself.
Right.
I mean, over time, basically, market calibrates itself. So
you could even pay too much for living the best business.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm going to ask you, hey, tangent.
You have nothing to add to that?
No, you've done a great job.
Oh.
I have a question, though. So one of the growth stories, and this is, again, because you're, so for the listeners who will obviously know if they listen regularly, but Doc is a technologist by trade, comes to us with a computer science PhD, so I go to him for all things technology because I just don't understand this stuff. For all of that, you talked about the number of internet connections, you talked about the fact of growing population. And as soon as you said that, I'm reminded of the acronym IoT, the so-called Internet of Things. Mm. Everything was supposed to be connected with a 3G, 4G, 5G SIM card, and talk machines were supposed to talk to machines. And the explosion in internet connections was supposed to be about the machines rather than about the people.
Mm.
And if you look at some of the brightest and biggest, you know, the graphs that are up and to the right, there's going to be X trillion connections at some point in the future, and the telcos are going to make money out of that. Was that so? And maybe we can't even know that yet. Maybe it's still going. But where are we with the IoT, the Internet of Things? Is it was it a pipe dream? Was it always overhyped? Do the telco players still have kind of another leg of growth, a kind of, you know, one last hurrah, a second act that comes through when IoT really takes off? Is it not going to be worth any money to them? Is it not going to happen? What should telco investors in particular, or potential telco investors, think about when it comes to the Internet of Things?
So that's a great question, actually. That's a little bit of a curveball there.
Sorry, mate. Yeah. that's what I do. We do preparation to this podcast, believe it or not. I just go off script all the time.
This is my bane.
Okay.
but here's the thing.
You handle it well.
I think this is a great question because, IoT, as you said, you know, maybe 3-4 years back was like, this thing is happening like now. Totally. Like it's going to happen like today.
If
you better jump on this bandwagon.
Was it Netcom Wireless that went through the roof because apparently it was supposed to be
like it was. Like there were quite a few, like and you know, you could just go back and look at the share prices now.
That's
like,
what I'm
know.
Thinking. I'm just having flashbacks. Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is correct. I think that I do believe that more and more devices are going to be connected. Mm-hmm. They're going to be mobile connected. So there's a mobile opportunity there. And I think 5G, for example, will eventually enable a lot of other things.
Okay.
So there's some growth there. What is not clear to me is that where is the value, right? So is the value going to be to the guys who are going to provide the pipe?
Right.
Or the value is going to be to the people who are going to provide the applications, right? So I'm giving an example, right? So every Tesla car comes with an internet connection, right? I believe Australia, it is from Telstra.
Okay.
Right. So if you add more, Tesla cars, they're going to be on 4G or 5G eventually. They're going to be on Tesla.
So on Telstra. Phone in the back pocket. Maybe they've got an iPad. Maybe they've got a Tesla car. So that's 3 connections. Well, broadband at home. That maybe it's a 4.
4. But then you can have, you know, the POS connections, right? You know, point of sales. Most of the points of sales are on 4G. But the thing is that the value creation, because they're charging you on the amount of data usage, right? Mm-hmm. So there's maybe like a $5 fee for a $3 fee for having the connection. And then some, if you're doing just payments on the POS, that's very little data.
Because you're sending a card number and an amount.
You know,
and something
some encrypted
else,
something,
like
bits
of data, rather.
Bits of data, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, a few bytes.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
so you're not making... I think it's hard to... So value creation is mostly going to come from applications.
Okay.
But there is some growth there, I get that. In just number of, I guess, subscribers, if we say, the growth is there. And it's likely to happen and probably going to, you know, take pace.
So how would you think about investing around IoT? Do you have a sector or a way to play it? Is it simply too hard, not just yet? Keep an eye on it. How are you thinking about, for our listeners, how do you think about investing around the IoT space, the Internet of Things?
So, I mean, one of the problems of investing in a theme is that you can't, you know, you need to have a basket to invest in a theme.
Okay,
right?
Yeah,
so
right.
One way to invest in IoT would be to invest actually in a chip maker that makes chips that goes into, you know, things that are going to enable these IoT things.
Right? So that's a better play than actually the network providers themselves.
Yeah, I think so. Because the chip maker might, if you're providing modems for 5G, the modems for 5G is probably going to be in every 5G device. So that's a much better play than just investing in one, telco.
And it's kind of a fixed price for the chip and all that kind of stuff. It's probably a higher price than maybe Telstra were going to get from the transmission of data for years, right?
Yeah. So
$1,000 Apple phone versus $3 a month for the internet. Yeah. It's a long time to get that money back.
No, also the scale and I think so. Okay. So that's one way, or some services that if, for example, some company is providing. I mean, there've been a lot of hopes and dreams, right? Mm-hmm. So you could have a company, for example, that could manage, say, your energy bills and how you're using, and do some demand response management for how things are being used at your home. When should you turn on your dishwasher?
Yeah, air conditioning, pool filter, right? Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, there's all these possibilities, but right now I think it's very hard to know who the winner is. Right?
Internet connected dishwasher, that's the future.
Yeah, I wanted a dishwasher which is actually auto going to load itself.
That's right. Talking about the Internet of Things, yeah. The Internet of doing stuff for me, the Internet of Chores.
Yeah, I think Internet.
We're coining that phrase now, Doc. The Internet of Chores. When you hear about this in 2022, guys, you've heard it here first.
Yep.
You had the opportunity to get ahead of it, but if it passes you by, you can open them up.
I'm all for Internet of Chores. Please come and cook for me, wash my clothes, and do my dishes. I will pay for that.
I'm thinking about the robot in the Jetsons. What was her name? Rosie. We need a little Rosie robot to come and do the housework.
Although you realize, right, when the robot is going to do that, we might not be here.
There is that.
Yeah.
Down with the robots.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of robots and the future and stuff like that, he says, desperately searching for a segue. This week, we've talked a lot about tech today, Doc, and Afterpay is probably the poster child for tech stocks, I think, at the moment. It's certainly, I did some numbers this morning. 3 years ago, $633 million market cap. Just recently, $6.8 billion.
That's a 10-bagger.
That's a very nice 10 in 3 years.
That's awesome. Isn't the wax better than the fang?
Apparently. Yeah, the old wax socks. Let's not go down that path. We do like tangents, but I'll try and keep us a little bit of time. So Afterpay kind of grew up a little bit this week. It's made some changes to its management team. It's bought in a Silicon Valley insider. The phrase alone is probably worth $1 billion for the market cap. And it's appointed an independent chairman. These are all things that are supposed to happen. I don't want to use the phrase kind of putting the adults in charge, because A, it's condescending, and B, it's overused. I don't even think it's necessary to use those words badly together. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the firstly, what are the changes after Pan? What do you make of them? Useful, worthwhile, window dressing, responding to investor concerns? What's going on at Afterpay? Is this the beginning of the next phase, or is this the kind of sign of maturation?
So some interesting things. We'll touch the independent thing later. But the interesting thing was Nick Molnar, who was basically the CEO, mm-hmm. and Anthony Eisen, who was in another role. They basically switched roles kind of.
Okay. And they were the co-founders, right?
Yeah, they're the co-founders. Okay. So, the way I think Afterpay put it is that this is really, I mean, this is the way they've been doing it before. The roles were just like that.
Right, okay.
And this is just a change of business cards, but nothing has really changed.
Okay. So they walked past out of the hallway and went, hey, I've been sitting in your chair. You've been sitting in my chair for a while.
Yeah,
should we let the ASX know? And they kind of, let's do that.
Yeah, so I think that's part of it.
Okay.
So that's
a non-event. Oh, almost.
Well, it's like,
it's nice to know.
Nice to know, but, so I think that's that.
Okay.
And the thing that you talked about, so they hired someone called Freck Fella from Facebook.
And you're a big fan of this strategy, if not, I don't know about this guy in particular, but you're a fan of the move they've made, right?
I'm a fan of this move for a couple of reasons. One reason is, Feller has a history of working with other big tech. So like mm-hmm. Facebook, of course, a big tech, but has worked previously with eBay mm-hmm. and PayPal. Yep. So it's got what I call the digital money connection, right?
Right.
So that's good. And the other thing I like about this is, this is what I call basically hiring a Silicon Valley insider.
Right.
On a chief operating officer role. It almost looks like, okay, this is the CEO designate in a few years. One of them probably is going to move into like a chairman role or something like that.
Okay.
Or a non-executive chairman role, and then have maybe, Feller run the ship, right? Mm-hmm. What I find interesting about this is that you've got, basically you were able to lure someone from Facebook, which is like, $400 billion company
plus $500 million.
That's slightly bigger than Afterpay's $7 million.
Like 100 times smaller.
Exactly.
Right? And into this role, mm-hmm. You have to convince this person that there is big opportunity here, mm-hmm. right? And Afterpay, as we think, is the biggest opportunity in the US, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is a sign of confidence. It's also a sign that you are able to tap into the right talent. Hiring talent is actually a big deal. And the best people want to work in the best companies or the companies that have the best opportunities. So I sort of look at this as a positive thing. I was very pleased with that part.
Okay.
And the independent chair, you know, this is a plus and a minus, right? I mean, if the founders have have controlling stake in the business, an independent chairman can do nothing.
And so just take a half step back. The ASX would say, and most corporate governance experts in air quotes would say, that an independent chairperson is the gold standard for board governance, right? It puts someone who's less of an insider, in theory, less conflicted, biased, call it what you will. It's supposed to put someone in charge who has a greater commitment to shareholders and maybe even the truth, and not necessarily in Afterpay's case. I'm certainly not suggesting anything wrong there, but as a governance thing generally, the idea of an independent chairperson is supposed to make sure that there's a kind of a disciplined arm's length decision making going on at the board table.
Yeah, there are many companies with independent chairmen which, you know, basically didn't. The independent chairman basically just said yes to everything, right? I mean, so that's that, right? To me, it means, is your chairman involved or not? Mm-hmm. And that chairman could be independent or non-independent, and, you know, are they making the best decisions for the company? And I'm not sold on this. I'm not sold on this continuous disclosure thing, and I'm not sold on this independent chairman thing. I mean, you know, it it's neither here nor there for me in terms of, I think, impact. I don't know. Maybe it's worthwhile to look at research that says whether research says the independent chairman helps or not. That to me was not, to me that was not the really critical. I mean, it's good window dressing to say, oh, now we have an independent chairman, now we have grown up, and, you know, maybe it's one of those things. It's a demonstration by the company saying, oh, look, we have changed roles, we have got a new COO, we've got an independent chairman, our disclosures are much better, more, you know, clean, we are an ASX 100 company.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, to me that's more like, you know, that's decoration. I'm more interested in the results and execution.
Exactly.
Give me the results and execution, and I really don't care about the rest.
I do have something to say about this one, mate, and it's only mostly to agree with you. I think the thing about rules is they deal with the lowest common denominator. Rules around the world for every possible purpose, not just even for the ASX, not even just for investing, are about making sure that the lowest common denominator of behavior is applied, right? And so at some level, if you've got in theory, a CEO who's using, and this is particularly so in the US, where quite often the CEO and the chair are the same person, you've got a CEO who's probably wielding outsized amounts of control over the board, and you're not necessarily having the right amount of oversight or governance of the company. The board of directors is supposed to be the owner's representative. The management are supposed to be the employees. And that makes a heap of sense at an arm's length kind of theoretical level. The best example on it, I have to bring up Warren Buffett at least once per podcast. It's in our contract. And so I will, just for the sake of saying, Buffett has been the CEO and chairman of Berkshire since 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And someone in 1967, under the current rules, would have said, no, Warren Buffett's not independent. We need independent, you know, someone, independent chairman. And similarly, you know, independent directors who allegedly aren't supposed to be connected with the company for more than a certain length of time. They all, you know, in the worst case scenarios, when you got malfeasance or wrongdoing at a company, you absolutely don't want those people in charge having too much power. On the flip side, if the guys Eisen and Molnar at Afterpay or Buffett at Berkshire or Jerry Harvey at Harvey Norman, just pick three examples, if those guys are the ones behind the success of the company, Jeff Bezos, right, Amazon, do you really want to appoint a professional director, someone who's going to come and dot I's and cross T's and you know, work on paperwork? And you kind of think, okay, those things have to be done. But if you know, we would, I think you'd agree with me, Doc, we would say invest in companies where you believe in and trust the management are doing the right thing for the long-term future of the company. If you're doing that, you kind of almost, independent chairmen aren't a bad idea. It's just kind of secondary, kind of tertiary issue, right? Yeah. If you've got a bad company, then yeah, sure. But geez, don't invest in a company that needs an independent chairman. That would be crazy. If you've got a company that's run badly or you don't trust, you don't know, you don't like, then I would say stay away. And if you like it, make sure the decision makers are the ones with influence, because you're backing Bezos, right? It doesn't matter who is the chair of Amazon in and of itself. Bezos is either going to get this right or get this wrong. Buffett, Again, the guys at Afterpay, same kind of story, surely.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with that. Yeah, I think again, it probably doesn't make a difference, and you want to see the people in charge making the right decisions. And ultimately, it's the decisions that they make, and we need to make decisions based on their decisions, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
And you know, if we believe in their strategy and it's working, then that's all we really
care. Particularly for growth companies, right? You're kind of betting on the guys in charge implementing a strategy that has taken them this far and will take them further.
Absolutely.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, we're going to go finish off with a mailbag question.
There's too much agreement today.
Sorry. I disagree. There's not.
Just,
is that better?
Too much. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
No, there's not.
I disagree.
Yeah. I agree.
You're right. You agree? Okay.
Yeah, you're wrong. No. Okay. Exactly.
Yeah.
We good?
Yeah, no, I think
okay, moving on. We had a question. So speaking of Afterpay, a little bit less than 7 days ago, in fact, last Friday afternoon, Afterpay shares took a decent tumble. And so while we're talking about the company, we thought we'd bring a question in from Samuel Turner. Sam hit us up on, I can't remember, I think it was Facebook, remember, or Twitter, either or. He says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. I'll deal with the obligatory pleasantries first." I wouldn't say they're obligatory.
That is not obligatory at all.
No.
Although, because if he's coming from Facebook, and Sam, you know, I'm not that big a fan of Facebook. I might just not answer that question. But
no, you want to answer this question. Okay. Sam's going to say some nice things about us.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Yeah. That takes precedence.
We've never said the pleasantries are obligatory, Sam. They're just non-negotiable. I'll deal with the obligatory pleasantries first. Love the podcast. Thank you, Sam. But in all seriousness, I really look forward each week to your detailed and amusing insights to the world of investing. He said in all seriousness,
But did he say only you? Doesn't mean you.
No, he said, "Hi, Scott and Doc."
Okay.
I think he means you're insightful and I'm amusing, or you're amusing and I'm insightful. I can't remember which.
Okay. Oh, well, either one is fine.
Yeah. Maybe we're both.
Amusing is also okay. I'm happy to be amusing.
He says, "I'm writing in regards to the recent shock horror news to the darling of the ASX, Afterpay. Do you think the news of Visa dipping its toes into the world of buy now, pay later services poses a huge threat to Afterpay heading forwards? Or is the market overreacting? I also found opinion that implied institutional investors sold out for the end of the financial year. I'd love to hear your educated opinions." Well, yours will be educated, mine will just be an opinion, on the matter. Thank you, gentlemen. Samuel Turner. Awesome question, Samuel, and I'm not going to answer this question because Doc is our Afterpay expert, so I'm going to throw it to you, mate. Visa is getting into the buy now, pay later space. In theory, going to try and take some of Afterpay's either current or maybe even future business away from it. Is this something to be worried about or much ado about nothing?
So I'm going to omit Samuel. Great question. First of all, thank you for that. And the first reaction when a big company like Visa says we're going to do buy now pay later is that not good, right? And that's a fair enough reaction. My first reaction is okay, this is not good. But if you think about it a little bit, it is not exactly what it looks like, and I'll explain that. So the first thing to remember is Visa, and I'll use MasterCard as well in the same phrase. Visa and MasterCard basically are payment network companies. Okay, so I'll unpack that a bit. So what they enable is when you basically tap on that POS with your Visa.
The POS being the point of sale system.
The point of sale system. Yep. You know, so you're basically paying the merchant that with maybe a Visa card.
Yep. I bought the coffee this morning. I put the Visa on the POS machine.
Yeah.
The coffee mob gets my $4.90. Yeah. That's how much it cost this morning.
Yeah, the $4.90. And that money then basically flows from the POS through to the bank somehow.
Right.
So the Visa basically and MasterCard basically run what I would call a highway. They run the highway through which the payments are going to flow, right? They also own the Visa brand, and MasterCard owns the MasterCard and Maestro and a few other brands, right? They basically allow banks to use those brands and the card in return for a fee.
Right.
So the lending is actually done by the banks.
Right. So if I've got a Visa card, the $4.90 I just spent this morning, my bank is on the hook for the $4.90. I've got to pay them back. Visa kind of just facilitate the transaction. They're the Australia Post of the transaction. They pick up the letter from one end, they drop it at the other end, and they say, "Good luck, guys, knock yourselves out." And to use the Australia Post branded system, you have to pay Visa a fee. Did I get that roughly right?
That's correct. Okay. Right. And they do other things like, you know, they would help you with fraud detection. They'll do the encrypted transmission, all those sort of things. They do all the good things. Like it's like, you know, paying a toll on the highway.
Right. So that means you can use your cards overseas and in different supermarkets, different retailers. You don't have to worry about, do you take the Bank of Melbourne credit card or the St. George Bank credit card or the Bank of Queensland credit card, you say, I'm going to use my Visa card, knowing that the retailer doesn't have to have separate arrangements with all the different banks.
Yeah.
They have the arrangement with Visa and they connect the two pieces of the pie.
Yeah. So this is a worldwide highway for payments.
That's pretty good.
That's a very good thing.
Now, lucrative business, I would have thought.
That's a very lucrative business. somebody should look up the MasterCard chart to see how lucrative.
Oh, really?
The MasterCard, just look at the share price MasterCard chart over 10 years. That has made squillion bucks for people.
Okay.
Disclosure, I own MasterCard shares, but I have not made squillion bucks on it. I will clarify that as well.
Right.
So now if you know that, the thing to remember is Visa and MasterCard do not provide credit, the banks do.
Right.
Right? Now, Afterpay might say that they don't provide credit, but they do.
Oh, they do.
Okay.
It's all their balance. Well, that's the difference, right? So Afterpay, the debt is on Afterpay's balance sheet.
Yes.
And with Visa, the debt is on the bank's balance
sheet.
Right, okay.
Right. Now, and in fact, if like I bought stuff online using Afterpay, I gave Afterpay my Visa card so that they can charge me the installments on there.
Okay.
Right. So in a way, Visa actually never loses in this transaction.
Unless you link your Amex to Afterpay or your MasterCard, right?
Yeah, well, in which case it does. But, but I mean, one of those guys are going to make money, right? Either it's Amex or Visa or MasterCard is going
to
make
it's
money.
It's also fair to say that in Afterpay's case, a decent number of the transactions actually go to an FPOS or bank account.
Yeah.
And so Visa actually, what Visa's worried about is if people start to link Afterpay in their bank account, all of a sudden, they cut Visa out of the story altogether.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So what Visa is basically enabling is Visa is saying we are going to enable a bunch of APIs to which essentially they're going to expose to banks, which will allow the banks to offer effectively Visa products with buy now, pay later functionality.
So does Visa carry the debt or the banks are carrying the debt?
The banks are still carrying the debt.
Right.
So, remember, because again, Visa is not carrying the debt.
So
right?
Visa is basically launching a new highway.
The same highway with more features.
Okay, that's
it's the same highway with another lane
on the highway. Another lane. Can I torture the metaphor?
It's like the bus lanes, right?
Okay,
it's like the bus lane equivalent. They're saying, okay, we're going to have a buy now, pay later lane, and we'll leave it to the various issuers to actually figure out how they're going to offer it. Right.
So is that a non-announcement then? Is there really anything they're announcing at all?
No, I don't think it's a non-announcement. I think it's a couple of things. A, Visa announcing something like this is an indication. It's, when the big guy takes notice of you and it basically says, you have arrived.
Okay.
So in a way, I'm saying Afterpay has arrived and their foray into the US basically has been noted and Visa is basically saying, okay, we need to do something about it. That's number one. That's good. That's a check mark in the Afterpay column. They have arrived on the big stage.
Okay.
Somebody big has taken note of it. and they're trying to come up with a response. The response part, though, I think, you're basically leaving it up to the banks. Well, the banks are really good at adopting stuff, but they're really not good at doing stuff, right? This is generally true for most banks.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So, so I think there's going to be a bunch of different products they're going to try. It's going to have the same sort of issues that we have currently. And the people who are using Afterpay, they're using Afterpay because they don't want to get this credit check and all these things. And they don't want to have debt from the banks because the credit card means debt. Although, I mean, Afterpay is also debt. But, it's all in the selling. It's all in the selling. It's all in the branding and all in the positioning, right?
It's a
completely different position.
Debtors have to pay money in a week's time.
Right. So it's just a different type of positioning.
Yeah.
And sometimes positioning basically matters.
Done well.
I think the biggest risk I see of this is that if there is some if there is uptake of the bank type of products or other people that try to roll out these products using Visa and or maybe eventually MasterCard, then the risk is that know your customers will become a more central thing, right?
And that the bigger buy now pay later gets, the greater the threat of regulation.
And which is, I think, a legitimate requirement. I've never said that you shouldn't have
that. No, we've certainly said that before.
We've said that before. And I think that would create some friction to the current buy now, pay later products from Afterpay, right? And I think that could actually slow down growth opportunities.
Interesting.
Right. So I think that's the lay of the land, right?
So you're not worried about it taking business away from Afterpay. Maybe it takes some of the future sales away, but the bigger issue is the rate of growth may slow?
The rate of growth might slow, depending on what sort of regulation get introduced.
Right.
And, again, it also depends on what sort of products compete in the market space. But, right now it looks like, Afterpay still has, basically the field to itself and can keep running.
And to be fair, if Afterpay in 5 years' time is 10 times the current size rather than 20 times the current size, still a nice problem to have, right?
It's a very, very nice problem to have. We'll take it. I'll take five times even.
All right. So bottom line, all of this said, both the changes to Afterpay's management and board and the potential, possible, maybe, threat from Visa. How do you think about Afterpay now compared to 10 days ago?
Right. So Afterpay is a recommendation of ours in one of the services that I run, Motley Fool Pro.
Yes.
It's a, you know, without going into too much specifics, for us, I still, and from the very beginning, you know, we've made a couple of buys of Afterpay. We've always said we look at Afterpay as a high reward, high risk position.
Right, okay.
I would even go so far as to say this is one of the highest risk positions we have.
Because of the business or because of the price?
Well, a combination of things. So the price is up there, right? The business is risky because there is all these issues around, you know your customers, you know, whether it's a credit product or not, it's a credit product,
competition.
Right. It's there's a lot of uncertainty around it. Its opportunity is huge. It's tapping, it's doing something really nice about being frictionless. It all those things are there. It's got momentum, it's got a brand. Afterpay it is like the thing. Okay, you can just Afterpay
it. Right, yeah, true.
Right? So those things matter, right? You know, just Google it.
Yep.
Afterpay it, right? Yep. So it's got all those things in its favor, and I think, yeah, so it's worthwhile for, we have a small position, relatively small. It's not really small, but it's small.
It's bigger now because it's gone up.
it's become a little bigger.
Yep.
It's something that I would caution people, you know, this is not something that I would be having a huge position in because it is just risky, right? And the thing
is... But you're happy with it being a small part of a diversified portfolio?
I'm happy with it being a small part of a diversified portfolio, largely, you know, you follow it. And, you know, as the story unfolds, you can always add, right? You know, you're not going to get maybe the 50 bagger or whatever. But, I mean, considering the risk and the reward, we think a small position is worthwhile to have, but I wouldn't make it significantly bigger, at least at the current position.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Mate, that brings us to the end of our podcast. The good news or the bad news, depending on which way you look at it, and it's probably good news for us. Next couple of weeks, we're going to be away. I'm going to be on my way to and from Birdsville in southwestern Queensland. You're going to be on your way to and from Italy via Canada. So we're having a couple of weeks off, fools. We have and are going to pre-record a couple of weeks worth of podcasts. So do hit us up on Twitter and Facebook as usual. Please keep listening in. We've got a couple of episodes in the can, as they say in the official language. We're kind of radio professionals these days, so we've got some episodes in the can. Next week is pretty cool. Next week, we're going to actually take a bit of a deep dive into some kind of investing in business concepts and issues, topics of kind of hopefully interest and certainly stuff that's pretty relevant right now. So I'm really looking forward to you hearing that one. We've recorded that already. I know how good that is. And we're about to record, although you'll hear this in a couple of weeks, a full mailbag episode. So for those of you who love our mailbag as much as we do, and hopefully that's most, if not all of you, we're going to have a full mailbag episode coming in a couple of weeks. And the week after that, we'll be back with you live. So that's pretty exciting. We hope you enjoy that. As always, though, you can hit us up on social media, on Twitter at TMFScottP, Anirban Mahanti, or at The Motley Fool AU. Hit us up on Facebook, find The Motley Fool Australia Facebook page, leave us a message, send us a direct message. We're open for all that kind of good stuff. If you need to, you want to use the snail mail, not the snail mail, the email, but the old school kind of direct email, info@fool.com.au will get your question or comment directly to us. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. That does wrap us up. But before we go, as always, make sure, especially while we're away, do us a favor. We're going to be away. Give us some good news to come back to. Subscribe, tell your friends. Go to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast in iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. Sign up, as I said, tell your friends. Leave us a rating, throw us some stars, and jump on to www.fool.com.au/Triple M. And you can get some foolishness straight to your inbox even while we're away. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of pre-recorded Foolish Insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.